I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Flying to Moscow to try and solve the Persian crisis, Kaba Mesultani, Prime Minister of Iran, is greeted at the airfield by Foreign Minister Molotov.
The Royal Navy patrols Egypt's coastline, while its carrier-based Venoms, Wyverns, and Seahawks carry out their task of destroying NASA's airfields and supporting the Anglo-French landings in the Canal Zone.
It is an all-out war. That's how Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan describes an invasion of the Golan Heights and the east bank of the Suez by Syria and Egypt.
We seek the immediate, unconditional, and complete withdrawal of all Iraqi forces from Kuwait.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
The United Kingdom is a great country.
Never been a good bet to bet against America.
Hello and welcome. This is Mid-Atlantic, where we dive into the stories that shape our world from both sides of the pond. I'm your host, Royfield Brown, who is sat in Birmingham, and it's been a wonderful Easter. So wonderful that Birmingham City beat Preston North End 1-0, and I watched it with my son. Now, in previous episodes, we've tackled some of the most contentious and heart-wrenching chapters of Middle Eastern history. We've explored Israel's current brutal war against Gaza, delved into the history of the foundation of Israel in 1948, and we've analysed the far-reaching ramifications of the Six Days War in 1967. Today, we're taking a step back to examine the broader canvas of Cold War politics in the region. Joining us is Ian Sanders, the host and producer of Cold War Conversations. He's a master in the understanding the tales of espionage, power struggles, and the silent wars that raged between the global superpowers of the United States and the Soviet Union from 1945 to 1991. With Ian's insights, we aim to uncover how the US and the USSR maneuvered through the shifting sands of the Middle East, influencing and reacting to events that shaped Israel and its neighboring states, from the Iranian crisis in 1946 to the dramatic implications of the Iran-Iraq war. We'll try and explore diplomatic maneuvers and proxy wars that defined the Cold War's impact on the region. But before I bring in Ian, I was going to say thank you to Content, which is the title of the review. And it was from Hells P1. And Hells P1 went on to say this: I find the show very informative as it tries to close the gap between Europe and the US. As a Canadian, we often feel that we are in the Mid-Atlantic now in understanding our friends on both sides. More Canadian content as it relates to this would be appreciated, i.e. trades and tariffs. Hells SP1, your wish is my command. We do have a little cadre of Canucks Canadians who are chewing at the bit to come back onto the show, and give us a couple of weeks and we'll do another deep dive into Canadian politics for you on Mid-Atlantic. Ian, how the devil are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you. And thank you for the invite on, Rofield. Really great to be back. It's been a while.
It has. It's been about 4 years. So it's,
really?
So it's about time that you came back on, that had you back on. One of the things which I've been doing, as I said in the intro, is trying to understand the ramifications of the state of Israel and Palestine. And I always say this now, for all of the geopolitics and internal politics that we look at on this show from the US and the UK, I'm more really a student of history. As well as looking at the contemporary stuff, we have looked at the formation of Israel in 1948 and the Six Days War, which is the war which excited me as a little 10-year-old, I must admit, getting the book from Perry Barr Library in Birmingham and reading about it, and tanks going through the desert and whatever. Yeah, for a 10-year-old boy, you couldn't get anything more exciting than that. But of course, it has massive geopolitical ramifications. But what I thought we'd do today is really look at some of those shadowy figures, those global powers that help to shape the Middle East as we understand it, because that gives us a real insight as to the state of the Middle East today, specifically Israel, Palestine, but also places like Syria, Egypt. These are really significant countries which were at one part of the Soviet Union's sphere of influence, and then Egypt flips over to America, etc. So I thought, you know what, instead of me trying to guess at all this stuff, why don't we have the big brain you, Ian, who can explain it all to us. So guns go silent in Europe, Nazi Germany is defeated in 1945, and I think conventional reading of the start of the Cold War really is the Berlin crisis. That's where people go, okay, I know Churchill's going to give us a speech about an Iron Curtain descending through Europe, but the actual ramifications of the two global superpowers having this standoff and the fact that the world could be at point of peril, that's the Berlin airlift in, I think, our common thought. However, there is the Iranian crisis in 1946, which in hindsight, we can see some of the patterns, can't we, of what's going to map out the Cold War. So why don't you take us to 1946 and the Soviet Union's refusal to leave Iran after World War II.
Flying to Moscow to try and solve the Persian crisis, Kavam S. Sultaneh, Prime Minister of Iran, is greeted at the airfield by Foreign Minister Molotov. This was the beginning of the talks and the oil agreement between the two countries. May this prove the end of a dispute which seemed to threaten the security of the United Nations.
Yeah, Iran was a key strategic area during World War II, obviously because of its oil riches. And the Soviet Union invaded Iran in 1941, and the British also came in. So it was jointly occupied by the Soviet Union and the Allies. Now, there was an agreement for both sides to withdraw within 6 months of the end of the war. However, the Soviets didn't do that. They stayed there and they tried to build a Soviet-style nation using the Kurds and the Azerbaijanis. So they were provided with arms and training and started to fight the Iranian forces in Iran. Iran, along with a number of these other Arab nations, had semi-independence and were generally governed by monarchies. The Iranian forces had about 2,000 casualties in this conflict, and the Iranian prime minister, under diplomatic pressure on the Soviets by the US, so by Truman, eventually led to a Soviet withdrawal and a dissolution of those Azeri and Kurdish states. That's it in a nutshell. A lot more happened, as with any piece of history. But
and it's significant, isn't it, that during World War II, there's a British sphere of influence, the south of Iran, as you said. And what happens is that the Russians don't immediately withdraw from their sphere. And the British have this sphere of control in Iran, in a way to help protect its Gulf War dependencies and mandates.
And also there's the commercial side of it as well. You've got British Petroleum involved in there. And so there's, I think one of the phrases is some of these countries, the majority of their revenue came from other nations effectively renting or using their resources or providing revenue from the use of those countries' resources. So there was a big commercial interests involved, essentially. I think Standard Oil was very much involved in it from the US side.
You're utterly spot on. And Mossadegh is going to be removed from power in 1953 by the Americans because he basically looks at BP and he says, I want to audit it because I don't think they're paying the Iranian state their dues. And the Americans, with us as the junior partners, put in or at least strengthen the monarch Shah Pahlavi, who becomes the last Shah of Iran. And this is one of the major reasons why we're going to have the Iranian Revolution in 1979. This is the West meddling in the politics of Iran. We see it as a strategic ally in that neck of the woods. And also, Iran is going to become part, a key part of CENTO, the proxy NATO formation. And that is going to be really quite important. So we have this Iranian crisis in 1946. Obviously, 1948, we're going to have the formation of the State of Israel. I think one of the things which, when you look back at the history of the formation of the State of Israel, you have kind of unanimity between the Americans and the Russians. Both of them are pro an Israeli state.
Yeah, that's correct. That sort of changes in the 1950s as, well, probably the main catalyst for this is around the overthrow of the monarchy in Egypt and Nasser, who was, it was essentially a military coup. He comes to power and his sort of viewpoint is a more socialist state. But what's important to note is he wasn't a communist. And whilst the Soviets supported his regime, he was allowed to suppress communism within. So the Communist Party was illegal in Egypt, yet they still had Soviet support, which seems like a weird contradiction. But obviously the Soviets were playing a strategic card here rather than an ideological card. And also around that period, Eisenhower is the new US president, and he comes in with his what was known as the Eisenhower Doctrine, which was economic and military aid to any Middle Eastern country that was resisting communism and demonstrating the US's commitment to countering Soviet influence in the region. So that money and that support generally went to the countries that were still monarchies at that time. And there were quite a significant number of countries that were monarchies. The only countries that weren't actually in 56 were Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Tunisia, and Sudan were republics. And also there's a big degree of Arab nationalism behind these republics as well. It's not purely a socialist viewpoint. It is that they feel they should be independent nations and not really under the thumb of... It's an anti-colonialist movement to a great degree.
Yeah, and I've mentioned this with Iran, but one of the ways to understand the Middle East is the withdrawal of British political influence, which fundamentally starts with when we pull out of Palestine. Also, at the end of the Second World War, our influence over Egypt is gone. And into that vacuum, and also the French, because of the World War II, their influence over Lebanon and Syria, that kind of goes. So into this kind of vacuum then comes the US and the USSR, and they take various sides. And I think it's really important to really talk about Nasser and this rise of pan-Arabism, as you've noted for us. But also that this is somewhat of a third way, isn't it? We see the Cold War very much as a binary, but actually we do have countries like India and to a degree Egypt who try and steer this kind of middle path, this third way, and hence we have the non-aligned movement. And then, of course, if we look outside of the examples of India and Egypt, also Yugoslavia in Europe. So there is this non-aligned movement. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, as you say, it was a bit of a third way to try and just, you know, remove this or try and have some sort of wedge to set apart that binary Soviet Union versus the USA there. And as you say, you had a number of countries becoming involved in that. I think Yugoslavia is a particularly interesting one because they were allies with the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. The Soviet Union helped in their liberation, yet they did manage to still carve an independent way. They weren't absorbed into the Warsaw Pact in the same way as the other countries of Eastern Europe were concerned. And they were important voices at the United Nations as well, despite the fact the United Nations had been set up in a way that gave a veto to the big old, what I would call imperialist nations.
And there is an echo of that in the current conflict between Israel and Gaza. It's not by accident that it's South Africa that has taken Israel to the ICJ. It's the echo of that non-aligned movement. And it is the global South who had been, let's say, ideologically, not necessarily against Israel, but definitely pro a Palestinian state. So we do see that echo in South Africa taking what it sees as a moral leadership role in terms of taking Israel to the ICJ. The state of Israel is founded, and as we've both said, is that this is a large event of which the Americans and the Soviets are broadly in agreement. And it's amazing listening to Gromyko's speech at the UN Assembly. He's the Russian foreign minister, and he talks about the need and the desire for there to be an Israeli state. But things are going to change in 1956. So we have the Suez Crisis, and the US and the USSR both intervene diplomatically to resolve this crisis. And this really, for us Brits, we see this completely as the end of empire, don't we? That we are very obviously the junior partner in terms of our alliance with the United States, and it ends any kind of French meaningful influence within the Middle East. But take us to 1956. We've talked about NASA. Why was a Suez Crisis, and how did we get, dare I say, our backside handed to us by our American allies?
Yeah, it was the last hurrah of empire, I think, Suez. Essentially, what the British tried to do was to retake the Suez Canal, which Nasser, the Egyptian leader, had nationalized. And they came up, along with the French and the Israelis, on a secret agreement for the Israelis to attack Egypt and for the French and the British to come in as though they were like a peacekeeper.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Being force.
The Royal Navy patrols Egypt's coastline, while its carrier-based Venoms, Wyverns, and Seahawks carry out their task of destroying NASA's airfields and supporting the Anglo-French landings in the canal zone. Working in close cooperation with the RAF, they play their part in a round-the-clock bombing program, which brings high praise from the Army chiefs. The accuracy and speed of their attacks makes the soldiers' job far simpler. And in this operation, watched so closely by the nations of the world, everything depends on rapid success. As the air assault continues, other naval units are taking part in the occupation of Port Said. Landing craft bring the army ashore, and at first there is little resistance. The docks are soon in Allied hands, and unloading goes on almost as smoothly as a peacetime exercise. Troops, equipment, and transport pour through the dock area in a steady stream, ready for action within a few minutes of landing. But the apparent lull may be deceptive. Inside the town, resistance hardens, and there are sharp clashes before Port Said is under control. The Allied forces confine themselves to dealing with the Egyptian army. They have instructions to spare life and preserve property as far as possible. But the worst of the fighting is over, and Port Said settles down to an uneasy peace, clearing up the mess and trying to get back to normal. Many Egyptians fought bravely, but for all Nasser's boasts and his big parades, his army is not an organized force. He declares that Egypt was taken by surprise, but that it won't happen again.
The Suez Canal is and was then a key artery as far as commercial seaborne traffic between Europe and the rest of the world, really. The British, in the meantime, and the French and the Israelis haven't told the Americans. So the Americans have no idea that this is going to happen. So the Israelis attack, the British and the French attack Egypt from the air and also land airborne troops and a seaborne invasion to recapture the Suez Canal. The Americans and the international community, including these non-aligned states and the Soviet Union, put a lot of diplomatic pressure to close this down. And the secret gets out that it's a put-up job. And as you say, the Americans very sternly let us know who is actually in charge of the Western world, and it's certainly not us.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, resigns in somewhat of disgrace, and it completely is the final death knell of any pretense of Britain and France being these kind of global great powers which have any sense of leverage against the US and the USSR.
I think it's worth mentioning that exactly the same time, the Hungarians in Europe are trying to throw off the Soviet Union. So they declare themselves a neutral country with it's still a socialist government, but they want independence, probably very much like the Yugoslavs. But the Soviets intervene, they invade the country, put down this revolution. But because it's at the same time as the Suez crisis, there's probably more focus on Suez at the time, and but they get away with it. Not that the West were necessarily going to intervene in that, but it's convenient for the Soviets that Suez happens at the same time.
That's a great point, utterly a great point. And one of the things which the USSR and the US are going to rail against in slightly different ways, but is imperialism, isn't it? That this is the 1950s is the great decade for decolonialization. Yes, India, Pakistan, etc., have become independent in the 1940s, but it really gathers pace in the 50s, where specifically the British put in transition many governments in the colonies to become independent, which actually happens in the 1960s. But really, that movement starts in the 1950s. Mm. And morally, the US and the USSR can talk about imperialism being a great evil, and both of them are anti-imperialistic powers. However, as you said, the Russians trample all over Hungarian independence, and of course the Americans are supporting any right-wing regime which is anti-communist throughout the globe and fundamentally want their man in place.
You can almost call it proxy imperialism. Is what the Americans were up to. You're absolutely right. They were very fearful of the British using American support for the British to hang on to their empire or to expand their empire. But the Americans were very keen to resist any expansion of communist rule anywhere in the world beyond what had been agreed at Yalta.
So in the mid-1950s,
there is a wider global strategy to contain the USSR by the US having a whole load of allied nations, which fundamentally ring the Soviet Union. So in Europe, we have NATO, which still runs to this day. In the Middle East, we have CENTO. And then in Southeast Asia, there was even a CETO with some countries who were implacably anti-communist there. So the countries of CENTO are the United Kingdom, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan. What was the position of the United States there? Why don't we say that they were signatories to CENTO as well?
They did come in about 2-3 years later, but they did supply military and economic aid, but they weren't the initial signatories. And the issue that they had was that because of the pro-Israel lobby and the difficulty of getting congressional approval was the reason that they gave there. I mean, there's other reasons that are out there. One of them is technical reasons of budgetary procedures, which sounds like BS to me. But in 1958, they did join the military committee of the alliance, but it is probably one of the least successful of the Cold War alliances because it's faded away and disappeared around the late 1970s.
Mm. It's probably easiest for us to try and understand the countries who are going to end up changing or flipping in the Middle East in terms of their support for either side. And so a country like Iraq is pretty fascinating because, as you said before, there's a lot of monarchies after the Second World War in the Middle East. There is going to be a revolution in the late 50s in Iraq. They're going to get rid of their monarchy. There's one in Egypt in the early 50s. They get rid of their monarchy. Tunisia, we briefly mentioned, in 1956, as soon as it becomes independent. But what is the situation like with someone like Iraq? Just give us a sense of maybe some of the stresses and strains that are put on these countries by the superpowers, why they might change, flip, etc., and the alignment moves over time.
Yeah. The countries you mentioned, you can throw in there North Yemen as well. They basically did have conservative regimes replaced by revolutionary Republican governments. There were also other Arab countries that were under effectively Western occupation or were under colonial rule, such as Algeria and South Yemen, which had nationalist uprisings there. And I think one of the interesting stories, which is lesser known, is that Syria formed a federal union with Egypt called the United Arab Republic, which is a little known aspect of this story. It didn't last, but it's an interesting story of two separate nations forming this federated country, the United Arab Republic. I guess the nearest comparison you can make in that area is places like the UAE, which was made up of a number of different emirates there. But as far as the Soviet Union, they wanted to support these revolutionary movements because it supported their whole story of being anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist. The US are going to try and finance the ones that are still monarchies or have right-wing governments. So countries like Jordan, for example, was one of the monarchies there with the Hashemite monarchies there. Morocco, Libya, Saudi Arabia, and North Yemen were also in those areas.
And I think Jordan is a real fascinating case study there because Jordan, after the formation of the State of Israel, Jordan finds itself in control of what we now call the West Bank, which it incorporates into the Kingdom of Jordan. So all of a sudden, it's the politics of Palestine are integral to the Kingdom of Jordan, but also pan-Arab nationalism, that part of the kind of tenets of pan-Arab nationalism in the middle and late 20th century is anti-Israeli, is to get back those territories for the Palestinian people. However, its king, Hussein, is actually very pro-Western.
Yeah.
So he reluctantly finds himself on the other side of conflicts with Israel, though there are many clandestine
agreements and meetings between Jordan and Israel. But for the sake of the real politique, this cannot be ostensibly actually said. So Jordan finds itself very much in the Western camp, even though many of its citizens would have been placably anti-Israeli, and there are dreams that there would be an even wider Jordanian kingdom, which would incorporate some of what would be Israel as well. That does lead us from Cento and the Suez Crisis to really talking about the Arab-Israeli conflict in a wider sense, and specifically the Six Days War, where the US supports Israel whilst the Soviet Union provides support to Syria and Egypt. And you mentioned them, they are part of the United Arab Republic. And the Soviet Union is going to be pivotal in at least the miscalculation that Syria and Egypt make, looking at troop movements, etc., that there were these diplomatic missives and the Soviet Union get that wrong. But why don't you take us to 1967 and how the two superpowers, how their positions play out with that dramatic Israeli victory?
Yeah, the Six-Day War was really a Israeli surprise attack on Egypt. What was happening at the time is Egypt had told the United Nations forces that were on the Suez Canal they had to get out. And in the process of them leaving, Israel sees a great opportunity to launch a surprise attack. And the attack is really effective. They essentially wipe out Egypt's air force, giving Israel air supremacy, and they capture the Sinai Peninsula, which is a huge geographical area, and they begin to reach the Suez Canal and do start to cross the Suez Canal. The Soviets are giving Egypt significant military resources, and they do have Soviet advisors there as well. And there's some talk of Soviet pilots actually flying the aircraft of the United Arab Republic, and there are accounts of Israeli aircraft shooting down Soviet pilots there. So it's getting really hot there, because obviously the US are supporting Israel. They're providing their military resources as well. But what happens is Syria then comes into the war, as does Jordan as well. And Israel is starting to be threatened on multiple fronts there. But a ceasefire is agreed, and the numbers of casualties on the sides really reflects how much of a Israeli victory it was. It was 20,000 Arab dead and 1,000 Israelis dead in that war. There's a couple of interesting incidents in that war where the Israelis attack a US signals intelligence ship that's out in the Mediterranean. They say they mistook it for an Egyptian ship, but it's an uncomfortable incident, particularly obviously with the US supporting Israel there. I tend to subscribe to the cock-up theory of history rather than any big conspiracy theory there. But by the end of the war, Israel have seized some key strategic pieces of land. The Golan Heights they've seized from Syria, which is the high ground that overlooks northern Israel. And you often hear about the Golan Heights in the news, but that is a really key part. They've obviously seized the Sinai, but they've also managed to seize the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. And this defeat really weakens Nasser's position in Egypt as well.
Yeah, 100%, so much so that he is going to offer to step down, and many people say this is somewhat performative, and it doesn't really, he had no intention of doing so, but he does go to the Egyptian people and say, I do need to step down. Which leads us on to the Yom Kippur War, and I think the position there of Egypt, which is still being supplied by the Soviets, is really quite fascinating, because what the Egyptians, and Nasser has gone now, Nasser has passed away, and Sadat is now the president of Egypt. What the Egyptians want to do is some level of face saving, really, isn't it? That they go into this war, and at best, we can maybe call it somewhat of a stalemate. What symbolically what the Egyptian troops are going to do is to cross to the other side of the Suez Canal. And that's incredibly symbolic that they're actually seen as retaking some level of territory. But just a few years after that, we're going to have the Camp David Accords, where the US brokers peace talks between Israel and Egypt. And this is key because Egypt is the largest in terms of population, but also the most formidable Arab military power raged against Israel. Maybe just take us from the Yom Kippur War and then just 5 years later, the Camp David Accords, and how that plays out politically with Menachem Begin on the Israeli side, but also with the Cold War powers.
It is an all-out war. That's how Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan describes an invasion of the Golan Heights and the east bank of the Suez by Syria and Egypt. The surprise attacks came early this morning in the air and on the ground. The Egyptians apparently have taken control of at least a portion of the east bank of the Suez. Dayan says it would take several days to drive them out of there, attributing the initial Egyptian successes to the thin line of Israeli defenses in that area. Egypt maintains it has taken control of the entire beach. On the Golan Heights, Syria claims it has taken some Israeli positions, but Israel says the Syrian attack now has been brought under control. As usual, there are conflicting reports on the casualties. Moshe Dayan called Israeli casualties reasonable. Egypt announced that it had lost 10 planes, but that it shot down 11 Israeli planes. Everyone agrees that this is the most serious fighting in the area since the Six-Day War of 1967.
All day today, Israeli reservists have been heading for their units. The streets have been full of military traffic. In fact, the big call-up started last night. Arab forces had been building up for 10 days, and intelligence indicated an attack was imminent. Israel could have struck first and gained the advantage, but this time the Israelis decided to wait.
Yeah, as you said, with Yom Kippur, this is the retaliation strike, which the Israelis were expecting, but it was a surprise being on the Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur. It did increase some very high tensions between both the Soviet Union and the US, which I'll come on to in a moment. The Egyptian and Syrian forces attacked into Israel. Egypt had crossed the Suez Canal and advanced into the Sinai. The Syrians were trying to recapture the Golan Heights and initially made gains there. It was about 3 days of heavy fighting, but Israel managed to halt the Egyptians and push the Syrians back to the pre-war ceasefire lines. And then the Israelis launched a counter-offensive that took them deep into Syria. They got to the point at which their artillery could shell the outskirts of Damascus. So they'd really made some penetration there. And also they'd managed to push the Egyptians back and started to cross the Suez Canal. Now, at that point, there was evidence that the Soviets were getting ready, Soviet ground troops, to actually provide to Egypt. And there was obviously back and forth between the US and the Soviet Union there. And the UN essentially managed to get a ceasefire together. But the Israelis had, despite being under a surprise attack, had improved their position from where they were with the Six-Day War. They'd actually got within 100 miles of the Egyptian capital of Cairo, which is really what got the Soviets nervy, because they thought, hang on a sec, this American proxy is going to take out the major player that we've got in the Arab world. And it was one of those points at which the Cold War could have got into sort of incalculable circumstances there, because would the Americans have just stood by, or would they have brought in ground troops as well? But these two wars, essentially with Sadat as well, made Israel realize, look, we're constantly going to be at war with these countries, so we've got to come to some agreement to try and stabilize the situation. And similarly in Egypt, Sadat had an appetite to do this. However, there was a significant opposition to him, which was his ultimate undoing, not so many years later after this. But it did lead to the 1978 Camp David Accords in the US, where Israel returned all of Sinai to Egypt.
Good morning. This is today, Monday, September 18th, and that is the White House, where last night an historic announcement was made. Egypt and Israel have agreed on the terms for peace. And tonight, President Carter will describe for Congress the historic breakthrough. This was the scene in the White House East Room as President Carter, President Sadat, and Israeli Prime Minister Begin concluded their nationally televised announcement of a framework for peace in the Middle East. President Carter, President Sadat, and Israeli Prime Minister Begin arrived in this capital last night from Camp David to make their historic and dramatic announcement of a framework for peace in the Middle East.
It was President Carter who had decided to call the Egyptian and the Israeli leaders together for the summit meeting, and it was Mr. Carter who explained the results of 13 days of work.
The framework document proposes a five-year transitional period in the West Bank and Gaza, during which the Israeli military government will be withdrawn and a self-governing authority will be elected with full autonomy. It also provides for Israeli forces to remain in specified locations during this period to protect Israel's security. The Palestinians will have the right to participate in the determination of their own future in negotiations which will resolve the final status of the West Bank and Gaza, and then to produce an Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty.
And made Egypt the first Arab country to recognize Israel as a legitimate state. And with that peace agreement, Egypt started to drift away from the Soviet Union and more into the US sphere of influence and US support.
Let's move on to Iraq and Iran, because that is a conflict which is seen as somewhat opportunistic in terms of the Iraqi attack on Iran because of the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
Despite the temporary imposition of martial law, the Shah's new government appears determined to press ahead with liberal reform. It is from the mosques that opposition to the Shah is being led by puritanical Shiite Muslims. The religious zealots want a return to the Constitution of 1906, which would ensure all legislation conforms with Islamic law.
Almost 40,000 refinery workers went on strike today, virtually cutting off Iran's petroleum exports.
University students demonstrating in Tehran, shouting death to the Shah, pledge allegiance to the Islamic movement of the Ayatollahs.
The number killed in Tehran since the beginning of the month is probably well over 100. But people in this crowd were saying and believing 7,000 had been killed. Emotions over the dead and the rumors of dead are high. Every day here now, the demonstrations and arrests go on. Rumors in Tehran say people are being armed and may soon start firing back at the troops.
News there would be some kind of announcement about a new government came after yet another day of running confrontations in the center of Tehran. The army kept moving today, trying to head off the demonstrations, keep them where possible from growing in size. This dogged military resistance to the anti-Shah disturbances, part of an effort to buy the Shah as much time as possible in which to create a political solution. Demonstrations like these today in Tehran are a daily occurrence in towns throughout the country now, and one sign of the fact there is nothing less than a kind of revolution being attempted here, trying to change the form of Iran's government, and unlikely to settle easily for any solution which still keeps the Shah on his throne.
Daily, it has become more difficult to look at the scope of opposition to the Shah of Iran and still see his monarchy surviving. The Ayatollahs are committed to the ouster of the Shah and nothing less than that. They chant, Magba Shah, death to the Shah.
The Iraqis, they believe that because of the instability in Iran, that they can attack and take border territory. And it ends up being somewhat of a quagmire. So historically, Iran had been in the Western camp, but that all changes because of the revolution in 1979. So where does the new regime with the Ayatollahs find themselves? Are they friendless? Are they drifting towards the Soviet Union? But definitely this is a point where Saddam Hussein, the leader of Iraq, sees that he can actually now attack Iran and because of the political instability, maybe make some military gains.
Yeah, the Iran-Iraq war is an interesting one. I remember this playing out in the 80s, and it's almost like background noise. But in terms of its scale and the number of people killed, it is a really significant conflict, and particularly for that area.
The wreckage of an Iranian jet fighter shot down over Iraq in the war that's shaken the whole Gulf region and the wider world beyond. The fighting, begun by Iraq, threatened to involve other Gulf states and even the Americans and the Russians, who both have deep-rooted interests in the region. The United Nations, the big powers, the Islamic states, all urged Iraq and Iran to come to the negotiating table. With oil installations sitting targets for modern aircraft and artillery, both countries could end up economically crippled, and the world outside could face an oil and energy crisis bigger than any that has gone before. If the war came as a shock to many people, it was no surprise to those who've been following relations between these two important Gulf powers. Their rivalry is, in fact, centuries old. But the latest tension's been mounting ever since the revolution that toppled the Shah and put Iran under the rule of Ayatollah Khomeini.
So there'd been a long-running history of border disputes between Iran and Iraq. And the plan for Iraq, as you said, was to take advantage of the post-revolutionary chaos there. And the original plan was to retake the eastern bank of the Shatt al-Arab, which was one of the key waterways right on the border with the two countries, which had ended up with Iran following an agreement in 1979. And Iraq had been stirring trouble by supporting Arabs in Iran as well. And that Saddam Hussein, who was the Iraqi leader at the time, was thought that he was also trying to annex one of Iran's provinces there. But the invasion just stalled. And I think what's important to remember is the Iranian army had been, as you said, was Western orientated, was trained by the US. They had British Chieftain tanks in their army. They had the latest US aircraft in their army, even though with the regime that they had in power at the time, they couldn't stand the Americans there. So they do manage to push the Iraqis back to the pre-war border lines. But the war lasts until 8 years. And it's almost described as a World War One conflict. There was attacks made with like human waves of troops, and about 500,000 people were killed during the Iran-Iraq war, with Iran with the largest number of casualties. And at the end of the conflict, there was really nothing there. There was no benefit really from either side. They almost ended up back at where they started there. But there were a number of proxy forces operating in both countries. So there were pro-Iraqi separatist militias in Iran, which I mentioned before. And also Iran were trying to stir up the Iraqi Kurds as well to try and get them to start a separate front there. But Iraq did receive a large amount of logistical and financial aid from the United States, the United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union, interestingly, as well as France, Italy, and Yugoslavia. And Iran was largely isolated, although it did receive help from countries like Syria, Libya, China, North Korea, Israel, interestingly, Pakistan, and South Yemen. So it's a really interesting war because it almost turns on its head what we were previously saying.
In the mid-1970s, the king of Afghanistan is toppled and there is a client communist regime which comes in, and Afghanistan borders to the south of the Soviet Union. And then there's going to be a lot of instability with the various regimes between the mid-1970s and 1979. And the Russians say that the good communist leader of Afghanistan invites them in 1979, which is ostensibly to go and prop up his position. This is going to be almost
a Russian equivalent to Vietnam, isn't it? Can you just take us through, Ian, that spread of the Russian involvement in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it's almost a war by accident that they end up in Afghanistan. They feel that this communist state on their border, they've got to support and that they've got to protect. And they fall into the trap that so many armies have fallen into in Afghanistan, which is they think we just go in with our military might and we'll be able to suppress any opposition that try and resist. But the Afghan population outside of Kabul are generally not in favor of the communist government, and they start to resist. And the US see an opportunity here to give the Soviet Union a bit of a bloody nose, and they start funneling extensive financial support and arms to the Mujahideen groups that are fighting against the Soviet occupation. Although I think the first CIA supplied arms were antique British Lee Enfield rifles, but the Americans rapidly up their game and they provide the Mujahideen with state-of-the-art Stinger air-to-air missiles. And the Soviets had been, whilst not being able to take the whole country, they were able to resupply and suppress the Mujahideen through their air supremacy. And by adding the Stinger missile into the mix in the hands of the Mujahideen, that significantly changed the picture there. So the Soviets essentially realized they'd bitten off more they could chew. Gorbachev's come in halfway through this war, and he's just looking everywhere to just retrench, try and save money, try and focus on restructuring the economy and getting the country in a better state. So the Soviet army eventually withdraw in 1989. The Mujahideen continue to battle the communist government in there, and they eventually fall. Can't remember exactly what year that happens, but it's in pretty short order after the Soviets withdraw their forces. Talk about history repeating itself. If you could substitute Americans and British in Afghanistan in the 2000s and 10s, 20s, and it's almost exactly the same story.
One of the ramifications of the American support for the resistance against the Soviet Union, they're called the Mujahideen, but they're going to morph and give birth to the Taliban and then also to another organization, which I think we're all aware of, Al-Qaeda. These are branches of that movement. So I suppose we have another conflict, which is the Iraq invasion of Kuwait, which puts a neat marker almost at the end of Cold War involvement in the Middle East. Because even though that happens in 1990, the Soviet Union under Gorbachev has bigger fish to fry, perestroika, glasnost. The restructuring of the Soviet economy fundamentally means that there is political upheaval with Lithuania declaring independence, though it's not going to be recognized for a little while. And I don't think the West doesn't realize what a precarious position the Soviet Union was in geopolitically. But what it does mean is that the US can put together this massive coalition to try and reoccupy Kuwait from Iraq. And there's even Syrian troops who ostensibly were Soviet allies in with that coalition force. And it shows you the amount of diplomatic and military leverage the Americans could wield when there wasn't the countervailing force of the Soviet Union.
And an explosive development near the Persian Gulf. Word that Iraq has invaded neighboring state of Kuwait, with fighting reported along the border. The residents say that they were awakened by machine gun fire and heavy artillery. For weeks, 100,000 Iraqi troops have been reported massing near the border. Arab countries have been trying this month to defuse this building crisis. In Washington, the White House is condemning the invasion, calling for Iraq to withdraw its forces immediately. The U.S. is also calling for an emergency U.N. Security Council session.
The Security Council passed sanctions, no more trade with Iraq, a boycott of Iraqi oil, a ban on arms sales, a ban on financial aid and investment.
Today, America
stops mulling over its options, reportedly sending United States warplanes and combat troops into Saudi Arabia.
We seek the immediate, unconditional, and complete withdrawal of all Iraqi forces from Kuwait.
From the beginning of the Gulf crisis, the underlying rationale for stopping Saddam Hussein has been oil. The oil-dependent world doesn't want a single man with a big army to control the flow from the Gulf.
With the Operation Desert Shield deadline less than 3 weeks away, diplomats and journalists are ready to leap at any trace of activity that might lead to the bargaining table.
Unless Saddam Hussein withdraws from Kuwait by late winter, the U.S. will go to war.
Yeah, and the Soviet Union was significantly distracted in this period. As you say, there was the nationalist issues they were having in the Baltic states. The process of perestroika and glasnost was not going well. It wasn't delivering to the Soviet population, and there was a massive amount of disappointment about that. And ultimately, you had the hardline communists in the Soviet Union with a coup in August 91, which significant, whilst it's overthrown, it's primarily overthrown by Boris Yeltsin, who was the president of the Russian Federation, is like the rallying point for resistance against this coup, which massively strengthens his position. And the Soviet Union fades away at Christmas 1991. But I think one of the other things that weakens the Soviet position is they have been exhausted. Their army's been exhausted and bled dry by their ill-advised invasion into Afghanistan in 1979. They finally withdraw in 1989, but they are significantly weakened by that as well.
The Soviet Union's gone. As you said, Christmas Day 1991, that hammer and sickle flag comes down over the Kremlin, and the Cold War is over. Looking back specifically at the Middle East, are there any kind of threads, themes, or conclusions we can come to in terms of how important it was as a theatre for the global superpowers?
It was always going to be an important theatre around the natural resources in those areas. And I don't think you can just look at it purely as land grabbing. It's very much about commercial interests and natural resources, certainly for the Western powers. For the Soviet Union, it's trying to, in its basic form, spread the revolution worldwide, which was ultimately the original ideal of the Soviet Union when it was formed. And anybody who was against the US was seen as an opportunity by the Soviet Union to try and get either client states or proxy states that were friendly towards the Soviet Union and friendly towards other communist powers. I think one of the interesting things that sort of comes out of this period is, as we mentioned before, there's the rise of Arab nationalism and anti-colonialism there. But with the breakup of the Soviet Union as well, there's also the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. And as you mentioned, with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, those are essentially born out of that period as well.
Ian Saunders, thank you for giving us a Cold War conversation about the Middle East. Tell people again where they can find your fantastic podcast, which I believe you only have 340 episodes of.
Only. I've really just not been working hard enough. So it's Cold War Conversations. You can find us at coldwarconversations.com. So Cold War Conversations is essentially a podcast attempting to capture as many oral histories of the Cold War as possible. My view is there's nothing like hearing history from somebody who was there. It will be across CIA, KGB spies, civilians, soldiers on the front line in Germany or in the DMZ in Korea. There's a real wide range of voices. And I guess one of the areas I'm quite proud of is that I try and capture a wide range. So about 20% of the interviews are, for example, women's stories of the Cold War, because I feel very much that the Cold War is thought of as blokes with guns and tanks, whereas the experience affected, you know, everybody. around the world. But give us a listen, coldwarconversations.com. Have a browse through. There's only 340 episodes there. You should find something you'd be interested in. We're on all the podcast platforms. We're on YouTube. So wherever you listen, you will find us, and you will be very welcome with all of our other listeners as well.
There you go. A great podcast. Go give it a listen. And when you go over there, tell Ian that Roy Phil sent you, and you're a big fan of Mid-Atlantic. We've got a busy week ahead of us this week. We're going to have the panel show, which is coming a day earlier. So we're going to have the panel with us, and we're going to have a couple of new voices with us. And one Irish Shapiro is going to be joining the panel. The great author who did the book about Mitch McConnell is going to be with us. And we also have a returning friend as well. I'll leave you to figure out who that is, or why don't you just tune in on Thursday, a day earlier, and you'll have that in your podcasting bag. That's been me, Roy Phil Brown, taking care of a little bit of a look backwards as to trying to understand some of the geopolitical forces which have created the Middle East as we know it today. And I'll be sat down with my good podcasting friend, Ian Saunders, to do that. Take care. Look after yourselves. And by the way, why don't you leave us more reviews? Please, don't ask for money. This is a free podcast. But why don't you just lean in and help us out with a positive review or five. There you go. Take care. Bye-bye.